walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm here today with the second half of my interview with Temple Grandin. You may recall that Dr. Grandin's been a guest 4 times on Talking Animals, but this was different. Earlier this month, I interviewed Grandin on stage at the 1,200-seat Paramount Theater in Austin, representing my first in-person extended conversation with her. That conversation was recorded. I aired the first half of it last Wednesday. I'll play the other half of that conversation in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak briefly with Don Goldstein of Greyhound Rescue Adoptions of Tampa Bay, or GREAT, who's become our de facto Greyhound correspondent. We'll discuss a recent report that documents an eye-opening number of Greyhound injuries and deaths in the last 6 years across the states that still allow Greyhound racing. More than half the nation's 21 remaining tracks are in Florida. The report constitutes a new, huge black eye, but it also will likely inspire some new legislative efforts. Additionally, near the end of the show is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a copy of the Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD. Now on to part two of my talk with Temple Grandin. Before we proceed, I think it's important to acknowledge I recognize that Dr. Grandin is not universally admired. For example, there's a contingent that feels considerable antipathy toward her because some of her more notable innovations are designs she's introduced into meat processing plants, that she works in the slaughter industry. As a passionate animal lover, I truly understand this position. It's certainly a high-minded position, but I think it also is a severely short-sighted one. As I commented in a Facebook thread last week, until everyone stops eating meat, currently scheduled to occur on the 12th of never, the sad reality is that animals are going to be slaughtered for food, and given that reality, I for one would rather have those unfortunate animals end up in a plant designed by Grandin. Hard to imagine how folks would hold a different view on that, but they do. Additionally, last week, also on a Facebook thread, I saw that a noted neuroscientist and longtime expert in animal behavior declared that Temple Grandin is quote-unquote a scam artist, and she doesn't know the first thing about the human brain. I must say I had not encountered that view before, but as with anything else, everyone has an opinion, and they should be free to express it, of course. All opinions are protected, even Rudy Giuliani's. My opinion, go without saying that I'm in the pro-Temple Grandin camp. She's unquestionably a marvel in virtually countless ways. That said, let's get on to part two of my interview with her, reminding you that I invited questions in advance for Dr. Grandin, which were emailed through the Paramount Theater's website, and I move a few of those into this interview. So, recorded February 7th, this is the second half of my conversation with Dr. Temple Grandin. We've been talking, obviously, throughout the evening about the spectrum. You can't really have a meaningful discussion of the kind we're having without talking about the word spectrum, which, of course, suggests something more sort of horizontal or linear.
Oh, no. I mean, you're talking about a spectrum that goes from Silicon Valley.
Right.
You wouldn't even have a computer if you didn't have some autism. You wouldn't have any electric power either.
Right. But I guess what I was saying is that the spectrum suggests something this way, but one of the things I really love that you have as a metaphor is a music mixing board.
That's
that
right.
That really captures the dimensions
right.
and the ups and downs.
Because
maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Slots. You got a whole lot of slots. And one could be visual thinking, could be anxiety, could be verbal stuff. There's a whole lot of slots. And, you know, when does abnormality become just normal personality variation? When does being slightly shy become Asperger's or autism? When does being moody become bipolar? When does being a little blue become depression? There is no black and white dividing line.
No, it's such a great visual.
No,
understand.
And I can't take credit for the music mixing board. I read that in an article. Some other geneticist used that, and I don't remember where I read it.
Yeah, but it really, I think,
yeah.
so
but I think
effective
it,
to
I convey. Think it's a very, very good metaphor.
Yeah, absolutely. It's clear, as we've talked about, that as a young girl, you just immediately felt a kinship with horses and cows, and that kinship, especially with the cows, informed and shaped.
You know, I learned to milk cows. At my boarding school. Boy, did I learn the work skills. First 2 years I was there.
Yeah.
I just lived in the barn.
But that really shaped and informed your
work
later in designing.
And this gets back to the whole thing of how do students get interested in things? If you take music out of the schools, how can a student get interested in a musical instrument if they don't ever play one? Theater's a great career, but you need to be exposed to it. And I was at Michigan State last year, and I ended up in a class that's one of these classes that students have to take to fulfill the science requirement. And they wrote down all these questions, and I looked through all these cards, and the most common question was, how did you get interested or get a passion for cattle? And I got to thinking, I was exposed to them as a teenager. Students get interested in things they get exposed to. And I'm concerned today in the schools, they're not getting exposed to enough career options.
Yeah.
And there's certain kinds of kids where skilled trades is going to be where they need to go. And working in construction, I worked with a whole lot of fabulous skilled trades people that I know were on the spectrum. You know, really weird welders, but they were very, very good.
Sometimes it's the weird welders that are the best ones.
That's right.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about, because of that kinship, and it did shape and inform your work, and let's talk a little bit about the designing the slaughter plants and other facilities.
Okay.
Because I think at this point, what, probably about 50% or more of all those facilities in the country are ones that you designed.
Well,
right?
The best way to put it is to put it by the number of cattle.
Okay.
Not the number of facilities, but the number of cattle. You take a really big plants, and you got three of them here in Texas, and 50% of the cattle, especially the fed cattle, are handled in a piece of equipment I designed called the Center Track Restrainer System. And if you want to see how that works, you can go look up Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. You can also look up Grandin.com. It's my last name webpage. I've got a lot of information on that. It's 50% of the cattle, not 50% of the facilities.
I see. Okay.
In North America.
Right, are all Grandin designed. Yeah, from
the Center Track Restrainer System.
And then do you want to spend a moment talking about the other elements like that you've implemented at the facilities, like the scoring system and the video monitoring?
Yeah, let's talk about the scoring
system. Yeah.
When I was young, in my 20s, and I think this is a mistake a lot of people make, I thought I could fix everything if I just had the right magic facility. And people think, oh, we put an iPad in every school, that's going to make everything wonderful. Well, it didn't. They just played video games on them, and they defeated the blocks. Good equipment, no matter what field you're in, makes it easier. But you have to have management to go along with it. And the thing I'm finding as I get older, people want the magic thing more than they want the management, all the details of the good management. So then I found that put in really nice facilities, half my clients tore them up and wrecked them. That was very discouraging, late in the 80s. Very, very discouraging. Then I started training management because I had to get management to buy in. That made some further improvements. And then I was hired by the USDA in the mid-90s to do a survey of plants, and with the help of Bonnie Buntain, a really great lady who's now the dean of the veterinary college up in Calgary, I developed a scoring system where you measure how the plant performs. I call it traffic rules for slaughter plants. Instead of telling them how to build things, they've got to achieve certain outcomes. In other words, you're going to fail the McDonald's audit unless you can shoot 95% of the cattle dead instantly with a single shot. And if you hang anything up live, you fail it. Numbers. If you have more than three cattle mooing their heads off in the stunning area, you're going to fail. And if you're poking them with electric prods or squashing them with equipment or whatever, you're going to have mooing, falling down anywhere in the facility, unloading, slipping, and falling, you're going to fail the audit. And the electric prod, you want an excellent score, you got to get that down to 5%. This is numbers. And in 1999, I was hired by McDonald's to train their food safety people on how to do this scoring. And at first, they were kind of skeptical about this animal welfare stuff. But then they saw how much good it was doing. And it just took off. And the thing I'm happy about, I used all of my design knowledge to not make plants do something expensive. You know what the number one cause of bad stunning? Broken equipment. Mm. They simply were not maintaining it. And I got a paper in the Journal of the American Veterinary Association on that. We had to do a lot of non-slip flooring, especially like in unloading areas, chutes, lighting. These are indoor facilities. It's amazing what you can do with lights. Add a light on a chute, change a light to make a reflection go away, put up a solid panel so they don't see people walking by, management, changing the numbers of cattle they bring up, the number of pigs they bring up, handling these small groups. And out of 75 plants in the U.S., only three had to build something expensive. We fixed everybody else with the simple things like the non-slip flooring, maintenance, lights, and simple changes.
And so what happens at, say, plant A over here if they don't hit that score?
Oh, they could get taken off the approved supplier list. Yeah, you see, this
and that
is
means
where...
they can't provide the food
well, exactly,
McDonald's,
let's
say.
Well, exactly. Yeah. That's right. That's the power of the pocketbook. And I saw more change happen in 1999 than I've seen in my whole career. Now, in the last 5 years, the USDA's gotten a lot more strict. See, in the past, they were not enforcing the Humane Slaughter Act. I can remember in the 80s when I was working on construction, and in the early 90s when I was out there on night shifts and we were installing equipment, it was terrible. It was horrible. It was just no management, busted everything, and you're not going to see that now. Things have really improved. Yeah, there's still occasionally some bad stuff. But let me tell you, the 80s and the early 90s, they were bad.
You're listening to the second half of an interview with Temple Grandin I conducted earlier this month at the Paramount Theater in Austin. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals, and we resume the conversation with Dr. Grandin describing the video monitoring innovation she introduced at slaughter plants to prevent sloppy, much less abusive, treatment of the cattle in those facilities. And how significant along those lines was the video monitoring?
Video monitoring made another step of improvement.
Yeah.
They... 1999 was like the massive tipping point. And then the video's been in now about 5 years or so. There was further improvement. And another thing...
We should explain that that's...
Right, let me explain how the video works. Yeah. You got cameras put in where the cattle unload, the pigs unload, going up the chute into the stunning area over the stunner so you can monitor that and then to make sure they're dead. And auditors... over the internet can tune in at random times, so you now avoid the problem of people acting good when somebody's standing there with a clipboard and see what they're doing and score them. And there were certain people that just wouldn't put the electric prod away. And the thing that was found, and I know this is not very nice, but there's about 10% of people that just shouldn't be handling cattle. They like to rough them up. What I have found on stockmanship, and there's a lot of interest now in low-stress stockmanship, and there's a lot of other people teaching low-stress stockmanship, which is really, really good. And you go out and train people. There's about 20% of people that will stay good. They're natural stockmen. And then there's a whole bunch of people in the middle you constantly have to supervise, and there's 10% that just should not be there. And I know that's not nice, but I know that, you know, the two plants that are doing the video auditing, they had to let go about 10% of the people.
Right. So the scoring system, especially the video things, would weed those
people
out.
Well, you see, what the video game, what the video did is, you see, what was interesting in looking at the video, the stunning didn't change. That was so dependent on equipment maintenance. That stayed the same. But what changed was the handling. Because they saw you with a clipboard, they put the electric prods away. But on the video auditing, you never knew when they were watching.
Very effective.
It was very effective.
Yeah. One of our questioners says, what is your opinion on the intersection of animal welfare and dietary choices for humans?
Well, that's real vague. I don't even know how to start to answer that.
You'd think I would have learned by now. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about, because we've been talking about the kinship that you have with animals, and that's obviously helped you design and figure out how they think and what's going to be more effective in those plants. So to what extent does that kinship extend to other animals, dogs and cats, for instance, among other animals? Do you feel that kind of connection with all animals?
Well, I know there's some autistic kids where a service dog has really been super helpful, and I get asked all the time about service dogs. And I say there's three different ways kids react to animals. There's the one kind where they're instant best buddies. It's just the best. Then there's another kid kind of afraid of the dog at first, but then they warm up to it. And then there's some kids where it's not appropriate, and it's usually due to sensory. They can't stand the smell of the dog, or it might drool on them. They have or it might bark and hurt their ears, and so they're afraid it might bark. Just like they might scream when they see microphones because sometimes they squeal if you get it too close to the speaker.
Yeah.
So I've talked to parents where their kid absolutely would throw a fit every time he saw a microphone because he was afraid it might screech.
Right, there was that chance.
And you can get the same problem sometimes with a dog or a cat. But you see, this is the thing. One size does not fit all.
Right. And how about you yourself? I mean, how do you feel about, let's say, a dog or a cat or other animals apart from cattle
and
horses?
Well, I find that, I can pet cats other people can't touch.
Okay.
Okay.
Well,
so and the other little tip is don't pat. Stroke it. Stroke it.
Right.
Don't do
this. There's a technique involved. Yeah.
Yeah.
This brings me to another emailer question. Do you feel your ability to understand animals is a genuine communication at the psychic or non-physical verbal level? Is this communication occurring at all times between man and animals, and are you more receptive to that language, or are you simply interpreting physical signs from the animal with a sense of empathy?
I think most people that are really good with animals are just good animal behavior people, and they pick up little postural changes. Okay, cattle and horses, when they switch their tail, they're starting to get upset. What are the ears doing? There's actually some interesting new research on cattle ears. And when they're horizontal, they're relaxed. And when they put them up like that, they're more alert on, you know, differences in ear position and how the animal feels. And I think they're just picking it up. I've had moms of nonverbal kids on the spectrum say, well, my kid's got to be psychic. He knows, when I'm getting ready to leave for work. And I said, yeah, I saw you pick up your purse and
your car keys. Yeah.
Well, even before the car keys get picked up, you're kind of bustling around and cleaning
up
the kitchen and knows the things that you do right before you do pick up the purse and the car keys. And there's a lot of people that are super good animal behaviorists, and they're really good at training horses and dogs and other animals, and they have a very difficult time explaining because they just get an emotional feeling off the horse.
It's an innate...
And I remember sitting with one of these trainers one time, and I said, well, you can't tell a student to get in tune to the horse. What does the horse start to do when he gets scared? And I got him to close his eyes and think. He says, well, the head starts to go up, the tail's switching, skin maybe quivering, starts sweating. Okay, those are things you can tell a student. And a lot of really great animal people, I've seen a little bit of Asperger's, a little dyslexia. I've seen that quite often.
For sure. And I wondered, with the kind of designing the plants and the facilities, if you've ever thought about maybe devoting some time to designing or helping design more effective facilities, either for zoos or sanctuaries shelters?
I've done some things with zoos. In fact, I worked with Nancy Erlbeck and some of her students down at the Denver Zoo. This was back in the 90s. And we trained Nyala and Bongo antelope to cooperate with getting blood tests and with getting injections and veterinary examinations. Very flighty animal. Nobody thought it'd be possible to do this. It took 10 days to train them to tolerate sliding door opening. And the first day, I moved the sliding door about this much, and it goes, shh, and that antelope orients. That's all we did that day. Because when that animal orients, then it makes a decision. Do I freak out, or do I just keep watching? The next day, we move it 2 inches, and it orients. You see, when the brain orients, that's when it either is going to keep watching or go into fear mode. And in the late 2000s, there's been a research study that showed the kind of a switch in the brain, the nucleus accumbens, that can either switch from seeking or to fear.
Yeah.
It's like a biochemical switch. But antelopes, in order to train them, you have to introduce new things very gradually and slowly. And we trained them, trained the untrainable animals.
So that was the training side of it. But I'm also curious, just given your gifts for designing facilities, if you've been asked to or considered on your own helping design more effective enclosures,
you can make enclosures that look really pretty, but you've got to give animals things to do. They're doing a lot of things with different odors in exhibits.
Yeah.
I saw something that didn't look very pretty, but the tigers thought it was wonderful. They had put a cable across with a pulley across an exhibit, and they put a box of meat on a cord and were bouncing it up and down like giant cat toys, and had the name of a meat company on the side of the box. And Big Kitty grabbed that box like a giant cat toy and tore it all up and thought that was really fun. And it didn't look very pretty, Big Kitty had fun with it.
Yeah.
And you could slide it along the cable and work it from outside the exhibit, so it was totally safe.
Some sort of food ziplining thing.
And you could pull it up and down and make the cat jump for it. And you've got to be careful with those things if you've got an animal that's out of shape, that you work them up to this slowly.
I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals, and you're listening to the second half of an interview with Temple Grandin I conducted earlier this month at the Paramount Theater in Austin. I pick up the conversation by my asking a question I liked a lot that was submitted beforehand through the Paramount's website. Also in this segment, we reach the end of the conversation proper and move into the Q&A portion of the evening. The Paramount is too wise to put a microphone in an audience member's hand, so in this recording, I boosted the volume of those questions. The audio quality, that part isn't great, of those questions. And then I generally try to repeat the question with my mic before Dr. Grandin responded. We're sort of nearing the end of our conversational time, and we'll get to some audience Q&A, but let me ask you one question that I'd like that one of our emailers sent is, what is the biggest lesson you wish humans would learn from animals?
Well, one of the things is still some people don't think animals have emotions. And in my book, Animals Make Us Human, Katherine Johnson and I covered the Jack Panskep research on the core emotional systems, which are you have a fear, you have separation distress. He calls it panic. I don't like that word because it gets mixed up with fear, because fear and separation distress are two separate brain systems. Separation distress is when you leave the dog home alone and it eats up the door and everything.
Yeah.
Then you have seeking. That's what makes animals go out and explore, makes some labs be, you know, big ball chasers. Then you have rage. And then, of course, you've got sex. You've got mother-young nurturing. That's the oxytocin system. And you've got play. And these systems in the brain are absolutely documented. And the thing that's really weird is it's been in the neuroscience literature for years, since the 60s and the 70s. But it never got out of that silo over into veterinary and animal science. Now it's starting to get into veterinary and animal science. But when I wrote papers back in the 90s and even in the early 2000s, and I used the word fear, they say, you can't write that. You have to put agitated or excited. And that's why I have a paper I wrote in the 90s on behavioral agitation. I wasn't allowed to use the fear word by the journal article reviewers. No, they definitely have emotions. What separates us from the animals is computer power. Just sheer computer power.
That's
the thing that's different when you look at the brain.
Well, this might bring us to one of our other emailed questions. I would like to hear comments that relate to anxiety, fear response in animals and human nervous systems as it might apply to autism. Parenthetically, this questioner notes, my adult son with autism suffers from acute anxiety.
Well, I had acute anxiety. I'd recommend they read the Believer in Biochemistry chapter in Thinking and Pictures. There are some individuals that need to take a low dose of an antidepressant like Prozac or Zoloft to control the anxiety. In fact, I think antidepressants ought to be renamed anti-fear drugs because that's where they seem to really work. But you often have to use much lower doses than that label. You go up to those label doses, you can get agitation, coffee nerves, they can't sleep. If they feel like they drank 100 cups of coffee, then you've got them overdosed on it and you've got to lower the dose. I know a whole lot of people, they'd be on drugs and alcohol if they weren't on a little dose of Prozac in the morning. I've seen it work on too many people.
Yeah.
And he sounds like one that may need to take it. I would recommend reading Thinking and Pictures really carefully because that's where I have my personal description. I've got other books like The Way I See It where it's a much more technical discussion. But that I describe my own personal experiences, and I'd recommend that he read that and they can make their own decisions.
Sure. And speaking of personal experience, we've talked about that you give lectures night after night. You travel around constantly. We were just talking about your next set of trips. So when you're not traveling and when you're not at the university teaching and you have maybe a little bit of time, what does Temple Grandin do for some fun or some hobbies?
Well, I like to go to certain movies that really need to be seen in a theater.
You know, for example?
Avatar would be a good example of that.
Okay.
That has to be seen in a theater. I saw part of it on a plane, and it was horrid on a plane. You know, you've got to, you know, there's other movies that are just fine on a plane.
Yeah.
But there's certain, like, you know, real visual movies that need to be seen on the big screen, and that's something I like to do.
So a night off at home, if there's a good movie
that
you think...
Gravity was another one. That has to be seen in a theater with 3D.
Big screen.
You don't watch that. I talked to somebody, they said it was boring on a plane. No, that's got to be seen in a big theater, in a nice theater.
Well, that's good to know. Excellent.
Yeah, that's stuff I like to do.
All right. Cool. All right.
Oh,
well,
and then
that's,
one other thing. I have a friend who gave me a Star Trek Mr. Spock shirt. I thought that was really cool.
Wow. Yeah. Nice. So you're a big
Yes,
fan.
I am.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, Dr. Grannon, great chatting with you this way, and I guess now we'll probably welcome some questions from the audience. So, we'll just put a call on people, and then I'll try to repeat the question so people in the back can hear it, since the guys don't have microphones. Go ahead, sir. Let me just repeat the question so everyone can hear in the back.
Sorry.
So he had a question about dog breeds and whether individual breeds had different behavioral or other characteristics.
Well, there are definitely different characteristics between different breeds. There's also a lot of variation within a breed. Let's take Labrador Retriever, for example. You can get those skinny, frisky labs. All they want to do is chase the ball. That's not the kind of lab they get for service dogs. They get a heavy set, really calm dog that could care less about the ball. And they're the same breed of dog, but both kinds of labs are very, very friendly. You know, that, there are some differences between breeds. And isn't the same thing with breeds of cattle, too. But there's also a lot of variation within a breed. And if you're interested in genetics, I've got a textbook, Genetics and the Behavior of Domestic Animals, which we revised last year.
Yeah. Well, you know, it might be interesting just for a moment to describe the red candle that you just saw, because I had never heard about that before, that you just told me about before we came
the
up here. Was it the Japanese red?
Oh, red cattle. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Bill Fielding.
Yeah.
I saw it, stopped by his ranch, and he's got Japanese red cattle. They have a funny name I can't pronounce, but it means red cattle in Japanese.
But they're actually red.
They are red.
Yeah.
They're like they're reddish brown. They're not as, they're light reddish brown. The Santa Gertrudis is darker, a kind of fine boned cattle. Very nice meat, and real kind of well-balanced cattle. I think one of the problems we've got today is we're over-selecting animals for certain traits and making a mess out of them. And we're doing that with pets, too. Like, you've got a bulldog now that can't breathe. It's a deformed monstrosity. And if you want to see a bulldog that actually looks decent, look up Bulldog's Dilemma on the Google Images. And there's a 1938 picture from the New York Times of a bulldog that actually had a snout and had some legs. That's what I call bad becoming normal. Overselect for single trait, you're going to wreck your animal. And these cattle definitely have not had that happen.
Other questions for Dr. Grannon? Okay, go ahead over there.
But you have excellent communication with lots of different species, but it seems a dog has a specific calibration to human emotions.
Oh, it definitely does. Dogs are hypersocial. We've bred them to be hypersocial. We definitely have.
My question is, they also seem to be hypersocial to other species more than, you know, when you see the orangutan and the dog, you see the elephant.
Oh, yeah, all that, what we're talking about here.
I was just going to say, question is about dogs being hypersocial to
bred them that way.
Other species
as well as
to humans.
Oh, we've bred dogs to be hypersocial. We've done that. No, that's been, you know, people did that with dogs. And they're a lot more aware of what people are looking at and doing than wolves are. There's been some interesting research on that.
Up in the balcony? Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Do you know a graduate program in clinical psychology and autism?
Graduate program in autism? There's a whole lot of them. All right.
Psychology and autism, is that?
Oh, there's lots of them. There's a lot of them. What do you plan want to do? Well, first thing I want to ask you, and I do a lot of advising on careers, is what do you want to do when you get done with a program? Sometimes you don't know. You want to work with little kids? What do you want to do?
Want to work with children on the spectrum.
Want to work with little kids on the spectrum? And you're a regular teacher now, elementary school teacher? You know, if you're working with the milder kids on the spectrum, if the kid likes art, let's do art with them. Kid likes math. Let's get a third grader that can do the next math book. You give them the next math book. Don't hold them back. That's a real common pattern. Little math geniuses get bored. Then they turn into big behavior problems because you make them do boring, stupid math. Then you get into the dumb arguments about teaching methods. Some kids are whole word learners for reading. Other kids are phonics, do both. Some kids, like me, I can't do math in my head. I have to mark when I borrow in subtraction. I got to mark the paper. I got really terrible working memory. So you let me mark the paper. Another kid can do it without showing his work. We're getting too hung up on how they're doing it. Different kids learn in different ways. I think we need to be looking at some of the controversies about things like Common Core. It's a destination. Don't tell me what road to take to get there.
This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to the second half of an interview with Temple Grandin I conducted February 7th on stage at the Paramount Theater in Austin. Actually, we're now in the midst of the audience Q&A portion of the evening, and we head into the final segment with an audience member noting that college may not be possible for certain students on the spectrum, hooking that into a question about Dirty Jobs host Mike Rowe, prompting Dr. Grandin to discuss the virtues of skilled trades.
And further back.
That right over there. I see you're waving like this. Yeah, go ahead, sir. Oh, sorry. Well, we'll get to you in a sec. I actually met the guy further back. Wait, I just want to get deeper into the theater.
We were talking earlier about individuals in school and having problems and maybe doing mechanical work and everything. Everything's geared to college now. Have you ever discussed anything with Mike Rowe?
Because
that's one of his.
Well, no, I've watched Mike Rowe, and I'm glad that he's out there doing the dirty jobs. But I did a lot of work for many years with a lot of great skilled tradespeople. Some of the most funnest stuff I ever did in my life was sitting around in some old grungy bar or restaurant discussing how to build things. They were some great guys and some really, really intelligent guys. And some of the work we had to do on remodel jobs, I mean, these were really hard, difficult things. They were not. simple things. I know of some people that are dyslexic that build feed mills for feed guards. And if you think those are simple things, why don't you type feed mill into Google Images? That would give a lot of people a little more respect for it. They're really complicated things. You know, big meat plants are very, very complicated things mechanically. You know, stupid people don't make complicated things. You know, there's a tendency to let people stick their nose down at, you know, skilled trades, but I've worked with too many really, really intelligent people in skilled trades.
Okay, sorry, the man who's got it before.
My grandson was 10 years old. He was diagnosed with autism at a very early age, so he was doing specifically for autism. And yet he still can't talk.
He still can't talk, and he's how old?
Let me just repeat, because he's so close. So grandson, 10 years old, diagnosed very early on, but no speech. Is that sort of the question for Dr. Gann?
If he's 10 years old and you get no words at all, no words.
Communicates with an iPad.
Okay, what some of the kids that cannot talk can learn to type independently. Some of them. And you want to use a tablet computer. And the reason for that is when you type on the virtual keyboard, the print appears next to the keyboard. Where if you look down at a laptop and I push a letter, I got to look up to, or on a regular computer screen, I got to look up. They can't make this attention shift. And some of them can learn to type. There's some good books on nonverbal individuals that have typed totally independently. My favorite is How Can I Talk If My Lips Don't Move? That's written by a young Indian man who looks very low functioning, but actually has a good brain in there. How Can I Talk If My Lips Don't Move? Then there's a Japanese one, The Reason I Jump, and there's another one, Carly's Voice. And they describe a sensory jumbled up world and all kinds of problems with their sensory system.
Before I have time for maybe one or two more questions. Go ahead, ma'am.
What do you recommend for the family of the 30-year-old man with Asperger's, high functioning, but he, I guess, hasn't gotten to the point where he can figure out something he wants to do? I imagine it's almost too late for him to explore things like mechanics and computers. All he does is play World of Warcraft and kind of use Asperger's as a crutch for not advancing in career or life.
So the question is, a 30-year-old man...
30-year-old.
High-functioning Asperger's, but not really pursuing anything, and is it too late, or is he kind of using that maybe as a reason to suggest it's too late to take on more?
Well, if he's actually built some computers, like to put them out in a computer store, no, there's a point where maybe someone needs to say to him, lay all the bills out. Here's our house payment, our car payment, insurance, electric bill and all these other things. You need to start, pulling some weight. You need to do is grease the skids and short circuit the interview process and figure out a place where maybe he can start having a job and maybe pay a few of the bills.
So it sounds like kind of a get tough attitude
and
now, right? Yeah.
This is just ridiculous.
So this is almost like your commandment about, or what I called your commandment about not coddling a youngster, or saying let's not coddle the 30-year-old.
You can still learn. I mean, when I was 30, I didn't even feel like I was a grown-up until I was 40. You see, it's sort of like you have a prolonged childhood. He needs to be getting out and doing some other things. And let's just start looking around the neighborhood, what businesses are around, little locally owned businesses that maybe he could start helping out in. Does he have any other interests besides Worlds of Warcraft?
Reptiles.
What?
Reptiles.
Reptiles? Okay. Maybe he can work at a reptile store. We actually have one in Fort Collins. Reptiles? Let's, how about a docent at the zoo? Okay. We're going to get him out of the house and he's going to do something with reptiles.
Thank you.
Okay.
Great. Let's do one more maybe up in the balcony. Go ahead. With that. Okay, all right, the very vocal contingent over there, let's do one of those.
As you were saying in the interview earlier about some people who were very good.
Okay, hold on, one at a time, sorry.
Can't hear.
Go ahead. No, it was the gentleman standing who's speaking. Well, are you guys standing right next to each other? I thought you both were together. Okay.
My brother has autism, but I just wanted him to ask a question because we brought him here because he really... likes you, Ms. Grandin, so I wanted him to ask his question so you could answer it because he really seems to appreciate your advice and stuff.
Okay, cool. So, go ahead.
As you were saying earlier, people who are very good with animals, you said that they were somewhat telepathic. And I was wondering if that could be possible with some veterinarians or with some psychologists that work with people who have Asperger's.
So the question is, people who have sort of a telepathic connection with animals, whether they're veterinarians or others? Okay.
Well, I think a lot of the people that really just have the really great way of working with animals, they just pick up, you know, animals do a lot of little postural changes, and they pick up on a lot of those little small signs, and they get an emotional feeling, but then they have a hard time, they're not able to describe what the dog did. And I've seen this with a lot of I've seen various horse training demonstrations where a horse is trained in an hour to ride, and they talk about getting in tune with the horse. But I think they just are very, very good observers of very slight, you know, changes in the animal's posture and demeanor and sounds it may make.
And also, I'm going to guess maybe part of what was behind this question, too, was you're noting that people who sometimes have that gift are themselves on the spectrum.
Oh, I've seen a lot of people that are super good with animals. I know they're a little bit on the Asperger autism spectrum, maybe dyslexic. And there was Monty Roberts. He actually wrote in his book that he was a black and white color blindness. I don't remember exactly, but he had something with his vision that wasn't right.
The join-up guy?
Monty Roberts. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's something with his vision. He may be a monochromat, which means he doesn't see any color at all, but I'm not sure. It's a long time ago I read that book, and I just remember there being something with his vision that wasn't right. Huh. And a lot of people that are good with animals are, you know, or I've got some of these various labels.
All right. Well, I think, unfortunately, we have kind of reached the end of our time, but you'll be in the lobby again signing books.
Yes,
and
I will.
Probably chatting here and there with
yes.
people as well. So, again, thank you very much, Dr. Grandin. And that concludes the conversation I had with Temple Grandin earlier this month at the Paramount Theater in Austin. I want to reiterate my thanks to Lisa Brass and everyone at the Paramount Theater, as well as to Dustin Slevak, who recorded the interview for me that night so that I was able to use that recording on these editions of Talking Animals. In a moment, we'll have a brief chat with Don Goldstein about some disturbing numbers contained in a recently released report about racing greyhound injuries and deaths and what implications that report may have for new legislative efforts. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Joe Zimmern with a second part of a piece called Pet Snakes on today's Comedy Corner. I'm Talking Animals.
Apparently snakes have taken over the Everglades, giant exotic anacondas and Burmese pythons. They don't belong there. Apparently people bought baby snakes. They didn't realize they grow to be up to 25 feet long. So at some point in that growth, they were like, hey, Mrs. Slithersby got scary. She just took a horse-sized dump. And our horse is missing. Have you seen Pony Danza? Maybe we should put her outside. She'd be happy in the Everglades, nice swamp, lots of old people. She'll do well. I know you guys think I don't have any more snake material. But my friend had a snake. And it constricted on his arm. This story doesn't end well. He had to cut off its head with a knife. He has permanent nerve damage in his arm. And he goes, I don't get it. 10 years, no problems. And then this happened. And I wanted to be like, well, I get it. It's not like it was sitting behind that glass loving you. It was just staring at you with eyelids that don't blink, hating you. And every day it was growing, waiting for the day when you could fit in its stomach. And after 10 years of that, he was like, screw it, I'm not big enough, but I'm tired of living in this fish tank. I don't care if he has a knife, let's do this, YOLO. I know, you only live once. Hashtag YOLO, the snake setup.
That was Joe Zimmerman with the second part of a piece called Pet Snakes, taken from his album Smiling at Wolves.
Right now, to discuss a jarring new report about the world of greyhound racing, let's welcome Don Goldstein back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
You bet.
So let's start out with the report. Who issued it, and what do you see as its most notable findings?
The report was issued by Grey2K USA Worldwide, which is a nonprofit that is working hard to reduce or eliminate the amount of greyhound racing in the United States and the rest of the world. And it was sponsored by a grant from the ASPCA. It gives a really good history, a full history of greyhound racing, particularly in the United States, although there are some references to the worldwide greyhound racing. And it focuses on the results of that racing and why it continues in the United States, even though the number of people that are attending the races and watching the races has gone down by, the estimates vary anywhere from 60 to 90% over the last 15 years or so.
And then I guess this raises, among other things, the age-old question of why does it continue?
Well, particularly in Florida, and we're down to 7 states that have live dog racing, and in those 7 states, there's a total of 21 active racetracks. But of those 21 racetracks, we have 12 of them here in the state of Florida. And frankly, it has very, very little to do with dog racing itself. Under current Florida law, in order to have a card room or a poker room, it has to go into an existing betting facility, read that as dog track, horse track, or a high life fronton. So there are poker rooms at all of the tracks. And in order to maintain their license for their poker rooms, their card rooms, they have to have the same number of live races, or 90% of the number of live races that they had in 1996, which is when the law went into effect. So we've got hundreds and hundreds of people at any given time playing poker, and not very many watching the dogs, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But they have to have the same number of dog races that they did then, and it takes anywhere from 500 to 1,000 dogs per track per meet.
So we'll come back to what that might mean. We've talked, you and I, on this show before about decoupling and sort of, in other words, separating those two things. But we'll come back to that in a moment. Why don't we, for better or worse, and in this case definitely for worse, why don't we talk about some of the specific statistics that were cited in that report?
It's amazing. Between 2008 and 2014, very nearly 12,000 injuries, greyhound injuries, were reported. And that, while that sounds like a giant number to me, one of the issues is they're not required to report injuries in the state of Florida. So over half of the tracks that have racing, we don't have numbers for.
Yeah.
And yet it's still 12,000 countrywide, or nearly 12,000, 11,700.
So it really is a double shot, because it's, to me at least, it's a staggering number. But as you just explained, who knows what the actual number is, especially given that Florida has more than half, I guess, of the remaining tracks that are operating in the country.
Correct. And if you throw in Alabama, which is the only other state that does not require, the only active state that does not require injury reporting, that's 2 more tracks. So that's actually 14 out of the 21 tracks do not have to report injuries.
So we have nearly 12,000 injuries, which again, obviously, is a number that's not anywhere near real. And then, unfortunately, we have how many deaths that they reported in that same period?
Well, in May of 2013, Florida, it was the first time that Florida required the tracks to report injury-related deaths, or excuse me, racing-related death. And since that time, we are averaging one dead greyhound as a result of racing every 3 days in the state of Florida.
Wow.
Yeah, that to me, that's just really staggering.
Yeah, lots of staggering things here, unfortunately. And then another thing that didn't capture quite as much attention as those numbers did, but still I thought was troubling, to say the least, was that there was, you know, a certain number of cases of neglect, and also that 16, I guess it was, race dogs were found to have tested positive for cocaine.
Unfortunately, a lot of the tracks, I mean, it's a business, and if the dogs aren't winning, then the owners don't make any money off of them.
And I guess the implied part of that explanation, Don, is that therefore some are being given cocaine to enhance their performance.
Yes. Anabolic steroid use is common, not approved, but it's common. In the state of Florida, the regulatory body there, unfortunately, I don't know whether it's understaffed or what, but their investigative arm is very, very slow on the uptake.
If there's good news anywhere here. I guess it would be the implications of this report for what the pending legislation might be. I mean, we talked a couple times when the legislature was in session last year and got sort of close, it seemed like, to a key bill that did finally die. But so as we gear up for a new legislative session, what do you think are the implications of this report?
Well, the big bill for this year, and as it was for last year, is an injury reporting bill. Last year, it was unanimously approved by the Senate, and that was on the last day of the legislature, and it was never considered by the House, so it died. This year, Senator Gardner, the President of the Senate, has promised that it will be one of the first bills considered. It has now cleared all, this is Senate Bill 2, it has now cleared all of the committees necessary before it goes to the floor. So the very first week of the legislature next week, it will be considered, and we expect, last year it passed unanimously, and it's nearly the same bill, so we expect it to do well in the Senate. We just have to focus on the House now. We're not sure. There is a companion bill that has been filed. We're not sure if it'll go that way or if it will be attached to something else, but we're working hard on the House side now.
Is that House Bill 129, or is that...
Yes.
Okay. So, because I guess the key question as we sort of come to the end of our time here today, Don, although obviously we'll talk periodically, especially once that legislator kicks into session and we follow exactly what happens with those bills, but what can folks listening do to help this process?
Let your senators and particularly your representatives know that injuries, this number of injuries to greyhounds, if it happens elsewhere, we know it's happening in Florida, we need to know about it. Transparency is the key to this. Let your representative know that you care about these greyhounds. They live in cages many, many hours a day while they're during their racing career. We need to know how many are actually injured. All we have is anecdotal information right now. So please let your representative know that you care about the welfare of these dogs.
And Don, I know that for ease of people doing that who may or may not immediately know who their legislatures are and representatives, is there still one or more websites that people could go to quickly identify who they should direct these comments to?
Yes, if you Google Florida legislature, there's a link right there. You put in your zip code, and it will tell you who your representatives and your senators are.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought sometimes, at least in the past, I wasn't sure if this was still happening, that Grey 2K USA, I think, also had some sort of a section on their website that made it similarly easy, but that's pretty easy.
Yes, they do. Yeah. They have a link there as well.
Okay, great. So we can also go to Grey 2K USA, I think, .org, if I'm not mistaken, and find your representatives there and send them off your concern about these reporting of injuries for racing greyhound friends. So,
or if they send an email to me at great-greyhound.org, I'd be happy to help them.
Okay. That's great-greyhound.org.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Don, well, thank you again for making the time to join us. Always important and informative. And like I say, we'll sort of track things and have you back on to get what I hope at least will be a serious progress report.
Hopefully it will.
Yeah.
Thanks, Duncan.
All right. Thank you. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's a special edition of Radioactivity. Rob is out today. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a copy of the Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD. We'll get to that in a moment here on Talking Animals right now. Time for a few animal news and announcements, starting with manatees. We're making national news. About 20 Florida manatees were freed early yesterday from a storm drain near Cape Canaveral, where they were apparently trying to warm themselves, officials and local media said, and there was video footage that showed them gathered and being rescued by various kind souls, so good for them. I think all worked out well. Want to remind you, we talked about this on the show last week, but two different events are coming up this Saturday in Gulfport. The daytime event is Get Rescued from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Beach Boulevard in downtown Gulfport. Huge thing with vendors, rescues, food, and fun. And then that same day, or that night, technically, it's Tales at Twilight from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Gulfport Casino Ballroom. So all that information can be found at by going on Facebook and just search Get Rescued. Yeah, I think that's it for now. Let's move on to Name That Animal Tune. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.com. WMF.net. Name of the album tune is a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something from WMF in the last 90 days. And there'll be a prize, a copy of the Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. A tip of the Talking Animals hat to Laura Taylor, who reminded me about this animal tune. And of course, her fabulous show, Surface Noise, airs tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. right now. It's Name the Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Well, we're not surprisingly, perhaps, getting a boatload of calls. Let's take one right now. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Ray Steele, Elton John.
Well, all right. The name of the animal tune and the artist. Excellent. All right, what is your first name, sir?
Joe.
Joe? Okay, cool. I'm going to come back and get your information and send you off a copy of the Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD. Thanks for listening. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we do have a winner, and we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Again, Rob is out at the moment, so we'll have a special edition of Radioactivity starting in just a few moments here on WMNF. I'll be back next Wednesday, March 4th, with another edition of Talking Animals that perhaps, curiously, won't feature Temple Grandin. Hope you'll join me for that. I hope you'll also visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow us on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a few days beforehand and other momentous news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond, Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Again, if you didn't have a chance to support our recent membership drive, or even if you did, send a few bucks. Go to WMNF.org. Throw a couple more dollars our way. We could really use it. We're trying to close that gap, and we're almost there, folks. All right, thanks so much for listening. We'll speak again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals.